call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water. It is a few minutes after 9 o'clock on Tuesday, day two of session. For those who were expecting us here at 8, so was I until about 4:30 yesterday afternoon. The bills were referred to this committee late yesterday afternoon, and our 1 hour posting requirements meant that we could not actually schedule this or post this agenda for any time before about 9 o'clock this morning, because none of the hours between 5 p.m. and 8 a.m. satisfied that 1 hour notice requirement. So thus our 9 a.m. start this morning. Members, I hope that it will be okay for us to go until 11. That's my intention. We'll use as much of that time as necessary, perhaps all of it. There is no floor session this morning, so I hope that you and your staffs can make sure you're able to be here for the entire hearing. We're going to take the bills this order. First, House Bill 3602, second, House Bill 3661, and third, House Bill 3613. And with that, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 3602 and ask Representative Jensen, who brings this bill to us, as well as anyone, kick it off, Representative Jensen, and then tell us who we should hear from next. I have a sign-up sheet here. You're in the wrong seat.
Thank you.
It's right there.
I just got promoted or demoted. thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm State Representative Bob Jensen from House District 58. And House Bill 3602 is a bill that I brought to the legislature for the Umatilla County commissioners. I have in the audience here this morning two of the commissioners, Commissioner Hansel and Commissioner Doherty, and accompanying them is their very able counsel, Martha Pagel, who has somewhat of a long and distinguished, I think, legal career and career in dealing with water, and also with, as a former director of the Water Resource Department, a lot of familiarity with the problems that we have. Initially, I approached this particular bill, and looking at the kind of circumstances of it, it looked like a very simple little bill. As time has gone by, I find that it's like all of the simple little bills that I've had. It has a lot of complexities to it, and so with your permission, Mr. Chair, I would ask you to entertain the folks who are here who understand far more about the technicalities than I do to come and present to you, and that'd be the people that I just mentioned.
Great. Thank you, Representative Jensen, and I have the list here. It looks like the commissioners, Commissioner Doherty and Commissioner Hansed and Martha Pagel.
Yes, Mr. Hansel.
Hansel, and yes. We'll have them join you up here. For those watching, you'll see us with computers. If we're typing, it's not because we're not listening to you. We are, in fact, most of us, maybe all of us, moving towards this paperless system. We're actually looking at bills in front of us, your bill, on our screens. We don't have paper copies. We're not using those for the first time this session, so that's why you see us punched into our computer screens.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Yes.
Just a slight digression. I am very proud of you all. I've been trying for two sessions, and this is the off session, to bring us to this point where we quit burning trees just for the purposes of making paper.
That's right.
For the legislature to pass out in huge quantities. So my compliments to all of you and to the staff, too, as they've worked through this with us to make this transition. I think it's a great move as far as efficiency in government, and I'm very pleased with that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. You helped lead the way on this paperless transition. So, commissioners, Ms. Pagel.
Good room. Thank you.
Good
Chairman Cannon and members of the committees, Dennis Doherty, Umatilla County Commissioner. Today, in this room, on this matter, environment, water, economics, and reality come together in real time. I want to start my few talking points with a reminder that in terms of a private sector hydroelectric project, there are at least six necessary components. The first one is a site, which Umatilla County has. Not that we wanted it, but we got it through foreclosure when this particular project quit operating and quit paying their taxes. We had no choice in that matter. The second component is what I would call hardware. That would be the turbines and the gates and the other things that are needed to operate the project. I guess we have that too, for the same reasons. The third one is water and the hydroelectric license, which the state has. The fourth is the FERC license, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission license, without which the project cannot operate. The fifth one is a market for the power that would be produced. And the sixth one is a project which is viable in terms of the economics. And I would remind you that this license was issued in 1985 by FERC. It was a 50-year license. Half of the license is gone. That means there's only 25 years left on this license for a new operator to recover their capital investment. It also means that any costs that are added to them up front are going to make it more difficult to meet the test of viability. And those extra costs could come in more than one way. They could be actual dollar costs to get into the project. They could be meeting requirements that actually reduce the output, and therefore, instead of having the up to 1.2 megawatts the project running at full capacity would produce, it could be less. And, of course, that would make it more difficult for the operator to meet the cost requirements. This particular project for Umatilla County is not something that we're enriching ourselves on. It was on our tax base at $340,000. It's essentially assessed as a utility, not by us, but by the state. I'm pretty sure I'm right on that. There's about 17 acres associated with it. That was on our tax rolls for about $17,000. The entire project, when it was paying taxes, was paying approximately $5,000, of which approximately $1,000 was retained by the county. The rest was divided up among the various taxing entities. So enrichment is not our goal. What our goal really is to avoid the potential liability that may accrue to us, may accrue to someone else if the project is not turned over to an operator who can make an asset. Because without being an asset, it definitely is going to be a liability. And the real question is, who is it a liability for? We're operating on the assumption that we may have some responsibility, even though we don't have any fingerprints on this project now. We don't have the licenses. We don't want the licenses. If we get the licenses, then we kind of take on a proprietorship role, and then we may have some responsibilities that otherwise I don't think that we do have, at least I hope that we don't have. So the real elephant in the room on this is, down the road, if the project is not made viable, who has the responsibilities for cleanup and decommissioning, which we don't have a fixed figure for, but which could run in well into the seven figures, possibly in multiples. So we think what we're doing by proposing this type of legislation is good for us. It's good for the state in case it has some similar exposure. In the federal, state, county system, we're at the bottom of the food chain, but being at the bottom of the food chain doesn't mean that we would welcome the bills when those types of liabilities come home to roost. I would suggest that two things. The preemptive issue here is probably what can all of the stakeholders and interested parties do to come together to permit this transfer of the license to a willing buyer, and how can we make that economically viable for the willing buyer? My second thought is that the solution that I would prefer is to have the legislature authorize the transfer of the license, not to Umatilla County, but to a willing buyer, and to make that feasible, empower the Oregon Water Resources Department to essentially oversee their part of that project so that they would have the final say on the transfer to a buyer that they find to be qualified, professional, responsible, and effective, and to further empower Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife to have a similar power so that they can, through negotiation and collaboration, establish whatever new standards are going to apply to the project, but not to include those standards in the legislation, lest whatever is included here preclude the transfer of the license to someone for lack of economic viability. I want to close by saying that I have really appreciated the assistance of Martha Pagel on this, and I've appreciated the extent and scope of collaboration which she has generated with her contacts with various stakeholders. It's my understanding that we have not got to where you would like us to be at this point, but we're continuing to work on that almost daily now, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Let's hear from the other commissioner, Commissioner Hansel, or
if I may, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'll go next. My name is Martha Pagel. I'm an attorney with Schwabe, Williamson, and Wyatt, and representing the county on this project. And as you'll recall, we had an opportunity to speak a few weeks ago at your interim committee meeting. And we're sort of jump-starting into the middle of the discussion based on the fact that we did have that opportunity for a pre-session briefing, but I'd be happy to back up and start at the beginning if any of you care for me to do that. What I wanted to do is to bring you up to speed on what's happened since your meeting. During our discussion, when you had the opportunity for a briefing on the bill, a number of questions came forward from you, and then following that from some of the interest groups who were in the room who expressed concerns about the bill. And the county then authorized me to convene an informal work group to flesh out those issues and to try to work on amendments to the bill that would address the concerns. And so we have been working with Oregon Water Resources Department, Department of Fish and Wildlife, the Umatilla Tribes, and Water Watch. I've also spoken with representatives from League of Oregon Cities and other folks who have called and expressed an interest. But our key players are those that I listed. And focusing on some of the issues that you all raised about what happens if this project continues. And recall that the purpose of the legislation is to avoid an automatic termination of the state hydroelectric license. Under current law, that's what happens when a project is taken over by a municipal corporation, which we understand to include a county government, is in this case. So we don't want the license to be automatically terminated. We want to have a chance for this project to continue. But questions came up about if it's going to continue, is it going to continue under the same terms and conditions that were originally licensed back in the 80s, or are there going to be some changes? And in particular, that focused on should there be changes with respect to fish concerns, fish passage, fish screening, or minimum flows that are necessary for fish. So those have been the focus of our discussions. We've also talked about ways to clarify the intent of the bill, to narrow the scope of the bill, and I think the work group is generally aiming towards a very, very narrow scope that really is going to pave the way for this project to be continued. And then if this is going to be embraced as a more widespread policy, that's something that should happen in the regular session, and we should gear up for that. So those are the general issues that we've been working with in the work group. We are pretty close. You'll probably hear from some of the members today. We're still working on it. We understand that you have a very short time frame to make decisions, so we're hoping to pull together some amendments for your consideration by the next time that you schedule the bill. Let me just also point out that at the last session, there was a request for more background on the project. I've included just a brief summary sheet of some of the key facts about the project, as well as a copy of my previous testimony to give you more background.
Thank you, Ms. Mm-hmm. May. Go ahead.
The only thing I would add is that, first of all, we appreciate, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. First thing I would say is we appreciate the
representative. You introduce yourself for the record, too, please.
I'm sorry. Bill Hansel, Umatilla County Commissioner.
Thanks.
Appreciate our representative, Jensen, taking this on as his priority bill for the session. Through no fault of our own, the county has picked up a piece of property through foreclosure. Normal procedure would be there: we go through the process, and it's sold, it's auctioned off at sheriff's auction. And if it doesn't sell then, the commissioners are able to negotiate under certain sideboards the disposal of that property. We are unable to do that bringing it back on the tax rolls without there being the ability for it to be operational. And that's what this bill is hoping to do, is to create the opportunity. We have a willing buyer. They approached us, a couple out of Utah, and they've done a lot of research on this, and they're willing to take it on. But we need to have some laws enacted in order for them to do that. And if we do that, then we move from a real liability to something that will be back on the tax rolls, protecting the fish, the flows, and this type of thing, so that we can take what otherwise is going to be a huge problem and make it productive. So we appreciate your attention to this, and hopefully you'll be supportive of us doing that in Umatilla County.
Thank you. Thanks. Let's see if there are questions from the committee. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Chair. I'm just, what is the biggest objection to this happening? What's the biggest problem this is going to create for everybody if we pass the law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, I think the key issue has to do with upgrading the fish passage and fish screening and the time frame for accomplishing that. I think there's actually generally agreement around a willingness to require upgrades, and the buyers are willing to do that, but it's a question of whether that must occur before they can start up operations again, or within a period of years following startup, or a shorter period of years or a longer period of years, and we're still working on that issue.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you don't do that, if this law does not pass, what happens?
Chair, Representative Benson, if the bill does not pass, then the statute directs that Water Resources Department must terminate the hydroelectric license. There's also a provision in the license itself that would require that it be terminated. If the state license is terminated, we believe it is most likely that the FERC license would also be terminated. There's a proceeding pending before FERC right now regarding surrender of the license, and they're kind of waiting to see what happens with the state process. If that happens, then either someone may step forward and try to apply for a new license for that project, which, as we discussed last time, we think would be very difficult to obtain under current requirements, or the project becomes derelict and somebody's got to take responsibility, and there would be a process through FERC, most likely, to determine whether it has to be removed entirely or partially removed, or what happens with it for decommissioning.
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who is most likely to be, I hate to say stuck, but stuck with the cost of decommissioning?
Chair, Representative Benz, as a representative of the county, I would like to say not the county, but there's a legal question there. The county owns the land. The county does not hold the license. The county would probably be looking to the state to say, it was your license, you take it out. The state would probably be looking to the county to say, you own the land, you take it out.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, when the county picks up foreclosed property like leaky gas tanks or brownfields or whatever, which we do on a semi-regulated basis, We are not responsible for the cleanup under statute. And we believe that there is a nexus to this. The cleanup would not be our responsibility. So that would be the position we would fight very definitely with. And we feel we have precedent to it for that.
One final question.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if the cleanup didn't occur, what's the damage to the reef, to this Umatilla? Can you walk away without there being damage and just ignore it? Or is this something actually has to happen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vance, we haven't got that far, but we're assuming that something would have to happen because you've got turbines, you've got oil, you've got a regular power plant there that at some point there's going to be leakage at some point. It's in the river. You've got canal systems. So there would be some cleanup, quite a bit, we would think.
Thank you.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would this project qualify for that piece on the RPS law that says 8% of the 25% from renewables has to be from a community-based project under 20 megawatts? Sorry about that.
Chair Representative Boone, I'm not sure.
Okay.
I have to check on that for you.
Okay.
Any other questions? What's the timing for the state revocation of the license under current law? How long before that actually, apologize if you said it, but how long before that actually would take place under current law?
Mr. Chair, are you asking when would the state terminate it or how much is left on the... there's no time frame specified in the statute. The Water Resources Department was looking into that, and I believe there's a representative here.
Yeah, we'll hear from them next, actually. Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. Stick around. Brenda Bateman and Dwight French from the department.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, representatives. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with the Water Resources Department. This morning I have with me our Water Rights and Adjudication Division Administrator, Dwight French. We wanted to just echo the earlier comments in terms of the timeline, the names, the facts of this particular bill and the case that it involves with the Boyd Hydroelectric Project, and to confirm that, in fact, the Water Resources Department has been at the table as part of this work group working to ensure that if a project were to be refurbished and brought back online, that it would be in accordance with the standards that the work group has been talking about in terms of today's environmental standards and not the original environmental standards that the department or that the project was originally constructed under.
Brenda, can you answer my question about when the license would be terminated under current law?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dwight French, and the Water Resources Department did not jump on this project as soon as maybe we could have to see that it was the license, in fact, would have been canceled. We knew that the county was in the foreclosure proceedings and trying to unload the property and working towards a sale. In the meantime, we knew that FERC was kind of in a wait position to see if the property could be passed along to a new owner. So we've kind of taken the stance that we'll see if something can be done during this session, and if something cannot be done to salvage the license, we really won't have any choice but to move ahead with cancellation of the license.
Thank you. Can you tell the committee, to the best of your ability, what the rationale is for the law as it exists relating to when a hydroelectric facility comes into the hands of the state or a municipal corporation, the license is terminated? Why is that the law currently?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I I apologize for not understanding the where that law comes from and why it's written that way.
You can't read the legislature's minds, is that?
No, not at least not 20 years ago.
Right.
Or how long it's been.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you. Phil Donovan and Kimberly Priestley. You're next. And if either of you have some perspective on the, or anyone else, some perspective on the rationale for this provision in the law, I think that would be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. And I've shared with you written comments that were approved by the Board of Trustees, and I'll attempt to summarize for you. First off, I'd like to point out that the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla were very involved with the original licensing of the Boyd Project back in 1984. And I got to tell you, it is fascinating reading to go back and read a FERC license authored in 1984. It only contemplates the reintroduction of salmon species in the Umatilla River. And you are all familiar with the successful story of reintroduction of salmon in the Umatilla Basin, a great story of both vision, collaboration, and investment. The Confederated Tribes of Umatilla appreciate that Umatilla County is in a very difficult and unique position, and we strive to be supportive of the county wherever we can, and we recognize that this project is a liability for Umatilla County. Our concern centers around if this project is restarted, we want reasonable agreements in place that this project will not harm the restored fish runs or damage our ongoing lamprey eel reintroduction efforts. And the challenge is today we're dealing with several unknowns about the status of the facilities for fish screening and for fish passage. We're in talks with the county and the potential buyers. Ideas have been put on the table that we are considering. You know, what it boils down to is that the prospective buyer believes that this project can pencil out, that you can make fish passage and fish screening, because everybody believes that that needs to be done. But they believe that they can make it pencil out, and that may be true. It's also possible that the dollar figure attached to fixing these screens may never pencil out. But we don't know that. We can't know that until the engineers get on the ground to provide specific information as to what the cost looks like. But I guess at this point, we're working with the different players, and we just hope that at the end of the day that you'll share our vision that if we pass this legislation, that it facilitates the transfer of ownership, but it also ensures that fish passage, fish screening standards are upheld. Frankly, we just don't want to restart a project that takes a step back in our fish restoration efforts. So I would conclude, Mr. Chair, I don't have an explanation for the rationale behind the law. When I saw this bill introduced, I thought, oh, that'll never involve me.
Don't you wish?
After a 2-hour conference call, it is very much involving me. Anyway, so.
Sorry about that. Thanks, Phil. Come on.
For the record, my name is Kimberly Precy, and I'm here representing Water Watch of Oregon. Chair Cannon, members of the committee, I have distributed written comments, and I just wanted to highlight a few key points. There's been a lot of discussion today about the existing statutory language that requires automatic termination upon foreclosure by the county, and we, you know, that is what has put the county in the bind it is today, and we do sympathize with, you know, their position. It's a hard spot to be, and that's why we are at the table trying to craft a, you know, trying to craft amendments to this bill that could move them out of this spot, but also protect the important fishery resources of the Umatilla Basin. That said, I did want to highlight the point that there's sort of another aspect of this story, aside from that one statutory provision, and that is that under the current license, there a condition of the license states that if the project is not operated for 5 years, that the state will terminate the license. There is also a provision in the license that says, upon termination of the license, the 500 CFS water right from the Umatilla reverts back to the public. This project has not been in operation since 2002. So technically, this is a water right, this is a license and a water right that should have been terminated. And I think that that's an important fact to keep in mind as we move forward, because from our point of view, what that means is that if someone, either the county or the assignee, wanted to continue operating this project, they would need to go through the new hydro statutes to get a new license, and also through a water permitting process. The standards that would apply to any license today are much, much different than they were in the 1980s. And, you know, it would be difficult, I think, to get a license in this particular case. And so I think that from our perspective, that lends to, you know, what we would like to see sort of in exchange for a legislative exemption from this termination. We think it's especially important that just the most basic of environmental standards apply. And as you've heard today, we've been talking about these within the group, and you know, we're hopeful that some agreement will be met, but I just wanted to highlight the points that are important to Water Watch, and that's one, that we have fish passage and screening that is brought to current standards. As Phil pointed out, since the issuance of the license, fish have been listed in the Umatilla Basin, and there have been millions of dollars spent on fish restoration efforts in the basin. And we want to make sure that if the project is sort of re-upped, that it doesn't harm those investments or those fishery resources. The other point is that at the time of the license issuance, the in-stream water right was not in place. There were no in-stream water rights on the Umatilla Basin. If the applicants were to go through a water permitting process today, they would be subordinate to the in-stream water right because it would be a senior right. It's also sort of as a side note, I did want to point out that the hydro project is actually subordinate to all water rights, all consumptive water rights, junior or senior. So the only pocket of rights that's currently is not covered by that subordination is the in-stream water rights. So as we move forward, we would like to see any amendments subordinate this right to the in-stream water rights that were set in part to help protect flows for listed species in the Umatilla Basin. And then finally, as I think Martha and others have talked about, we agree that this bill, if it moves forward, that it should be narrowed to the unique situation facing Umatilla County. I think they are, you know, as I said at the outset, we recognize that they are somewhat in a bind and we sympathize with them, and we are willing to discuss legislation with regard to their specific situation. But, I do want to say for the record, some of the stuff that we are discussing as far as the terminated water right and sort of getting around that termination raises really large policy concerns for Water Watch, but those would be somewhat alleviated if we could narrow down the bill. And with that, I just wanted to say I'm hopeful we will come to resolution on this issue, and if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Questions, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It occurs to me, I probably could have asked this, maybe should have asked this to Martha or Brenda, what, and you touched on it, what happens to this water right if we do nothing? Right, and not only generally speaking, but as practical as specifically as possible, is there an ag user who would most likely get, you know, additional water rights? Is there a new application that would get it? Does it go to in stream? Help me with that.
According to the terms of the license, you know, if this, as Dwight said, if this bill doesn't move forward, the department would move forward on termination. The water right would revert to the public. My interpretation of that is that it sort of returns to the pool. But it is important to note that this is a non-consumptive right, so I do not believe it would affect water availability as far as other consumptive users. However, while it's non-consumptive, it is important to note that this project, it's not on the Umatilla River. It's on a side channel. And so right now, my understanding is that the project is not operating. They are not diverting 500 CFS from the Umatilla. If this project moves, so if the water right were canceled, then for that mile or so of stream where it's diverted before it goes back in, if it's canceled, then the water would keep going down the main channel. But what's going on, if it in fact is revived, then the water right, you know, they will be able to pull out water out of the Umatilla River through the canal. And so we just want to make sure that if they do that, that the in-stream water rights for the main stem would protect flows in the main stem for the fish.
Great. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And this, we may need to take this offline because this might have been a better question for Dennis or Martha or somebody else. But I'm trying to get, before we hear this bill again, speaking to the gathered wonderful people, better understanding of sort of our best alternative negotiated agreement. If we don't do the bill, what's the best alternative, and what are alternatives to the bill? Not saying the bill might not be the very best alternative. So at this point, I don't know how expensive removal costs are, for instance, right? I don't know if it's $700 million or $2 million, right? I have no idea. And I have no idea what would be potential beneficial uses of the equipment, of the land, of any other thing, and who would benefit from, I mean, would the net cost be $700 million or $2 million, or $700 or $2 million minus X, and I have no idea what X is. So would love to have that before we do the next thing on the bill, and don't think probably either of you would necessarily know the answer to that.
Representative Boone?
This is kind of a dumb question, but I got to ask it. Kimberly, you just said that the project's on an off channel to the river, and so the water, right now the water is just flowing through, nothing's happening to it. And if this is not a consumptive use, in so many words, if it were reinstated, wouldn't it just pull the energy out of the water and put the water back in so there's really no net loss of water?
Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, the way it works right now is, here, if I can draw a picture, if you don't mind. So you've got, this is my understanding anyway, and I do have to say that this project is new to me, unlike the tribes. We just became involved as of this session. But my understanding is you've got the main stem right here, and here's the channel, and you've got a hydro project on the channel. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm understanding your question correctly, if the project isn't revitalized, is that...
If it is
revitalized, okay. So right now the project has not been in operation since 2002, so the water is going down the river.
Right.
If the project is turned on, mm-hmm. the water will be coming through the channel, and this section of the river will be minus 500 cubic feet per second. And so what we are advocating is that the in-stream water right be met, which is, you know, it ranges from, I believe, I attached it to my testimony, but it ranges from, you know, 120 to 300 CFS, depending on the time of the year.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the only addition that I would add to that is that there are minimum flow requirements that are written into the FERC license to ensure that there's continual fish passage. And I'll just go on the record and saying that, you know, there's some nervousness about this project because in the past there have been fish kills associated with it. There are reports that were supposed to be filed that we cannot find because or suspicion is that it was never filed. And that's not to cast a pale over what the future owners may do, but on behalf of the tribes, there's been some concern about how this was operated in the past, and it wasn't always good for fish, even despite a FERC license.
Well, and I've been actually to that project, seen those fish, and followed that whole story way back whenever it was 10 years ago, through when I was doing watershed council stuff. And it's a great project, and it's a great thing that they returned the fish there. So what I'm thinking is, I mean, you got the principal people in the room here hearing your concerns and have said that they're willing to address them and are working with the, all the stakeholders to do that. It sounds to me like there's a way to get to yes, as a famous senator here in the building says.
We hope so. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kimberly, I'm interested in your little chart you have, or visual that you have there. How long is this channel, this loop that you've got? How far from point A to point B on it?
It's approximately a mile.
Yeah, that's right. Chair Cannon, Representative Jensen, members of the committee. My understanding is that it is approximately a mile. I'm happy to find out the exact length of dewatering and submit that to you in the future.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I visited that, and if that's a mile from point in to point out, I might be able to run a 3-5 mile.
Mr. Chair McCannon, the project description is it's a 5,300-foot long canal.
Chair Cannon, Representative Jensen, I think I would like to add to that answer that I think I'm not sure that it matters so much how long that period is. I mean, it matters somewhat, but the fact of the matter is you are pulling flows from the main stem Umatilla, which is, you know, maybe different from other projects that are built on the river. And so there is a diversion, and that's our concern. And that's why we would like to see it subordinate to mainstream water rights.
Great. Well, thank you both for your testimony. As I think we gather, there are still some issues to be resolved. I think everyone, all the parties, understand the timeline that we're working under. House bills have to have left this committee by a week from Thursday, which is just 3 more committee hearings. So we have a short time frame. Certainly hope that we can find a way to move this forward, and we'll be following up with the folks who have testified today, as well as Representative Jensen. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3602 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3661. The list here, and we'll start again with Brenda Bateman and Doug Woodcock from the Water Resources Department. Members, I'd like to draw a couple of letters to your attention. One is the letter that was sent by the department after our last public hearing on this issue related to exempt wells. That letter was distributed to you via email, and perhaps Brenda, you would talk about that today to clarify and correct some of what we heard in testimony back on the 14th, I think it was. And also, members, I received a letter yesterday from the Westview Irrigation District, and if that has not been circulated to you, I will West Extension Irrigation District, and if that has not been circulated to you, I will make sure that it is, but it's a letter in support of House Bill 3661. Brenda and Doug.
Good morning again, Mr. Chair, representatives. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with the Water Resources Department. This morning I have with me from the department Doug Woodcock, who is the manager of our groundwater section. The testimony that we've submitted today is the same that you saw a month ago. Wanted to make sure that you had that in front of you. And so that is just stepping through some of the changes that this bill would create in our statutes, ORS 537-545. We're happy to walk with you through that again this morning if need be in terms of understanding what's on the books today and how this would change those aspects. But the chair also mentioned a memo that we submitted last after the completion of the last hearing in January 14th, and I wanted to just walk through those points very briefly. They were in response to some of the conversation that ensued after we'd left the microphones last time. The first was to recap just a little bit about Senate Bill 788 from the 2009 session, and there had been some discussion about talking about or addressing some exempt use well issues, and so hadn't those issues already been addressed? In fact, Senate Bill 788 did address some exempt use well issues, but very different ones. For the first time, that bill required folks to register or record those wells with the department, to pay a $300 recording fee along with that, and also to provide a map with the exact location of that well. So they were pointed at exempt use wells, but addressing very different issues there.
And could you, Brenda, describe what those, the best of your understanding, what the purpose of Senate Bill 788 was? Because it was alleged that Senate Bill 788 from 2009 really got at this issue of exempt wells and the pressures that they may place on our aquifers. From your perspective, what was the intention of Senate Bill 788?
Yes, Mr. Chair, 788 really at its heart was focused on getting a good record of the location of the well, to make sure that we had that so that when our water masters were called out to address issues of interference or other items, that we would be able to find those wells and do the measurement and testing and look that we needed to take. That's in comparison to House Bill 3661 from this session, which is really looking at the volume of use that would be associated with each of those wells.
Thanks, Brenda. Go ahead.
To continue looking at the memo of January 14, there was also a discussion about the half-acre lawn and guard exemption that is mentioned in this new version of the bill, and how group domestic users would be confined to watering within 1/2 acre of lawn and garden. And the point that we wanted to make today was that those groups, while their total footprint may indeed be larger than 1/2 acre, they are held to a 1/2 acre standard today. So that concept of 1/2 acres spread over a group of domestic users is not a new concept for those groups. Wanted to let you know that that's the status today as well. And then thirdly, we wanted to talk a little bit about the second part of the bill that would reinstate an authority that the Water Resources Commission used to have, and that was allowing them the authority to require permits before any exempt use wells would go into what's called our groundwater administrative areas, our withdrawn areas, limited areas, and critical areas. And we wanted to make the point, because there was some discussion, that there are already authorities that exist today, and that this reintroduction of an authority would not be needed. And we wanted to let folks know that today the policy tools that we have available to us are very blunt and very broad, where we can either say you can have exempt wells or you cannot have exempt wells in this area. It's a pretty blunt instrument. What we don't have is the ability to take a look before someone drills a well and provide a review for injury or provide a review for water availability and make a decision before a well is drilled. So I wanted to ensure that you knew that authority is missing, and that's what that paragraph would address.
Thank you. Doug, are you here just in response to questions, or did you have any prepared remarks for us?
Yes, Doug Woodcock with the department. I do not have prepared remarks for you today. I'm here to respond to questions.
Great. members. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before, when we were listening to this, it seemed to me that this was a bill seeking a purpose, and I'm still thinking that. And but I want to ask some questions. Maybe you can clarify for me what the true need for this bill. Am I correct in understanding that if a water master goes out and sees a household wasting water, they currently have the power to do something about it?
Chair Cannon, Representative Benz, that is correct. The water master does have the authority to regulate those that are wasting water.
And with this bill in hand, the evidence of the waste of water that they would rely upon would be the same. That is, they see water running down the street, or maybe they see water running 5 weeks in a row on the same half acre.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, that's correct. If there is no change under this bill with regard to if a water master witnesses a waste of water, if they were to observe that, then they can work with the landowner to stop that waste. That's correct.
I apologize, Mr. Chair, for not asking. Follow up. The other purpose of the bill appears to be to determine before someone drills a well out in the countryside whether or not there is water available. And it's my recollection from my years on the commission is that this determination of water availability, because of budget constraints, is difficult. And many times we err at the department level in which direction when we don't know the answer.
Representative Benz, currently our authorities with regard to assessing water availability are limited to the permitted uses, so those folks that come to us with an application to use groundwater. Then we have a location of a well, we have a proposed use, we know which aquifer they are targeting. From that, we can do an assessment of the existing uses that are there as best as we understand them, and we can look at the current stability of the resource based upon any data that we have available to us. In the exempt use realm, we do not have that authority right now. The wells, there is an exemption out there to go ahead and drill a well and put your home in, and there is no ability to look at that to assess whether it makes sense to have a new subdivision go in an area and perhaps may exceed the capacity of the resource, or that we may be in an area that already has well interference issues. So that is what this bill is striving to get at, is in those areas where it is warranted, where it makes sense to do so, the commission could require that exempt users, those that want to use wells for the domestic purposes and the lawn and garden watering, come to the department and seek a permit first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious how many current demands there are for subdivisions scattered around the state of Oregon. I'm just guessing that there are none, but the much more likely scenario would be someone who wants to put a home, maybe on a Measure 49 or Measure 37, whatever it is, lot. And how long would they, if this bill passes and they need a permit, how long would they have to wait for the department to act? And secondly, how much more of a budget addition will you need in order to prevent people from waiting an undue amount of time for a decision on this type of issue?
Representative Benz, first of all, I would like to point out that the department, neither the department nor the commission, has any area targeted for this. This is a tool to be used in the future in the event that something comes up, but there are no areas there. So we do not have any subdivisions. We do not have anything targeted that would specify that we need an increase in budget to look at that particular, those few applications that might come in under this. With regards to the question of how long it takes to get a permit, I believe statutorily it is about an 8-month process, something like that. That is not to say that the process undertaken in this statute would necessarily have to follow exactly as we do a full-blown irrigation permit. That's not something that we've discussed in-house, but These are relatively small uses we're looking at. This is really about the ability to review the stability of the resource and interference issues prior to the development of that in areas that are already identified as groundwater limited, critical, or withdrawn. And so, you know, there may be some opportunity to do something different than what we currently do under our permitting process.
Thank you.
I want to get back to the authority question, because we've heard several times that the department has the authority to regulate use to purposes that are beneficial. And I think the implication or the inference then is that the gallon per day doesn't really matter. That reducing it wouldn't give you an additional tool. If it's the case that you have the authority that it's alleged that you have, then why have a gallon per day maximum at all? What is the effect of the 15,000 gallon per day maximum now, and what would be the practical effect of lowering that from 15,000 to 5,000 on these domestic exempt uses?
Chair Cannon, currently when a water master, it's a complaint-driven system largely, and so let's take the example of a water master receiving a complaint and going out and having one neighbor stating that his other neighbor's water use behavior is exceeding a beneficial use. So the water master looks at this. What he can do, he or she can do, is look at how the water is being used. So the indoor use is generally pretty small. The outdoor use is generally the large quantity of water that's used under the exemption. So the water master will then measure off the acreage that is being irrigated. And the only limitation under the exemption at this time is that it is limited to one half acre of non-commercial lawn and garden. So once the water master measures that off, then it's either in or out. Now, there could be an excess of water that is being applied, but that gets to be a bit more problematic. The neighbor says he's watering all the time. He's really wasting the water. The water master does have the authority to require a permit, but so often, I mean, in practical matters, so often water issues between neighbors stem from other issues, and water is just one of many issues between the neighbors. So there is an expense involved in having this supposed offender meter their water use, but the water master does have that authority. What this bill does do, and to follow up, if I may, regarding the water running down the street, if in fact they are watering so heavily that there is watering down the street, that would be evident to the water master and they could regulate at that point. What this bill does is it sets a volume limit on that outside irrigation. It takes that half acre of lawn and non-commercial garden, folds it into the 5,000 gallons a day for the single domestic, folds it into the 5,000 for the group domestic. And so should a complaint arise, not only is there an acreage limitation, but there is also a volume limitation that the water master could use. And yes, it will require that a meter be installed, but at least there is a limit there. So this is an additional tool that the water master can use, and it's a practical tool for them to use.
Can you imagine a scenario where more than 5,000 gallons per day could be used beneficially to irrigate a half an acre of lawn and garden?
Theoretically, no, Chair. There is the use indoors and there is the use outdoors, so these are merged together. Generally speaking, looking at that, it should be accomplished within the half an acre, within the 5,000 gallons a day.
And what if somebody's using close to 5,000 gallons per day for their lawn and their garden and their indoor domestic use, but they're also, say, watering their horses and watering their cattle, and that pushes them above 5,000? Under this bill, would that be prohibited?
Chair Cannon, under this bill, that would not be prohibited. The 5,000 gallons per day is restricted to the single domestic, the group domestic, the commercial. Stock watering is not limited to 5,000 gallons.
What about the kids' 4-H animals?
Chair Cannon, I think that would fall under a stock watering.
Okay, how about filling a 1,000-gallon tank on their firefighting rig?
Chair Cannon, that would, if that were considered a domestic use, it would fall under that. If this firefighting rig is a commercial operation, then that would fall under the 5,000 gallons for a commercial.
Okay, how about filling a 5,000-gallon tank on a sprayer in the spring, washing dirt off a combine tractor or other equipment, treating wheat, mixing cement? This is, and I don't know if you've seen the letter that Mr. Kosasen circulated to the committee, but he posed an example of a sort of extremely rural person who, family, who is using a lot of water for the purposes described here, and I'm trying to get a sense of how much of this would be impacted or could be impacted by the bill that we're considering, because I think it's not our intent to prohibit this family from doing what is described in this letter.
Chair Cannon, I would think that the Water Master would take a close look at this. We have many of these examples that each year somebody gets called, or the Water Master gets called out, and they look at how the water is being used. So there is a domestic piece. So that is domestic and ancillary domestic uses. So if in fact those uses are attributed to the domestic use, then it would fall under the domestic piece. If it were the commercial, it would fall under the commercial. Hosing off a combine, I would leave that up to the Water Master, I think, as to whether that would be considered a commercial operation or not.
Treating wheat.
Wheat.
Yeah.
Chair Cannon, that would be considered, that would be a wheat, I would think, shooting from the hip here, would be a commercial operation.
Okay.
Thank you. Or perhaps an irrigation operation.
Any other questions? Representative Benz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative
Benz. I'm clear, I don't know if 5,000, 10,000, 50,000, I don't know what is right. I just want to know when the department's going to actually use the 5,000-gallon number. Tell me when you're going to actually use it. Give me like three or four examples of when this thing will actually make a difference.
Representative Benz, that is essentially a line in the sand. It is a number that the department can look to assist in sorting out water management issues. So the department is not, this is not an angle to require people to meter their wells. There's nothing in this bill that gets at the metering of the use. This is essentially a reduction in, I think for the most part, the single domestic piece, because it comes back from the 15,000 gallons down to the 5,000 gallons. There is no change, essentially, for the 5,000-gallon commercial piece. They are still allowed 5,000 gallons. With regards to some examples as to how this would be used, I provided one example where a water master is called out on a complaint regarding a waste of use by a neighbor. I could see the 5,000 gallons coming into play with regards to county planners. When they contact us and they ask us for what kind of water can be used in the area, this is an example where we could provide to them, well, these are the limitations for how water can be used under this bill should it be passed. Today, it is, well, they are limited to 15,000 gallons, up to 15,000 gallons for the single domestic, the group domestic, plus the 5,000 gallons for the commercial industrial. And you get into the stacking piece there. So this would constrain that in that regard. Regarding a third example, Representative Benz, we're very much an agency that is looking for the tools to manage the water resources, and this bill narrows that broad use that is largely unused it's 15,000 gallons, but we all know that it's something much less than that. Bringing it back down into 5,000, I think, is a more realistic number, but I don't see that that is going to have a dramatic effect on the existing users that are out there. Should it do so, this, well, I use the term a line in the sand, it does not mean that line cannot be crossed. We have an entire process out there that we can put people into a permitting process to get a permit to use water in excess of that 5,000.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. Let's just go to the one example you used where actually something might happen. The neighbor sees too much water being used. The water master is called. What happens next? I mean, my question is, how do you find out that they're using more than 5,000 gallons without imposing a measuring requirement?
Representative Bentz, there are several aspects to the exempt use. It is the limitation on the outside watering, so there is the half acre. So the water master has that ability to measure that. Beyond that, it is the use. It is how much water are they actually using. And so our agency is really about making people that are not in compliance, bringing them into compliance. So the water master is going to interview the person who is using the water, look around to see how it is that that water is being used, and if it appears that there is an excess of water being used, then the water master has the ability to require a meter for that use and can follow up. And if they are exceeding the 5,000 gallons a day, then we are in a matter of compliance. Our water masters work with the users to bring them into compliance. So they either reduce the amount of water that they're using per day, which would bring them into compliance, or we work with them to get them onto a permitting path to make them legal.
I know Representative Thompson had a question. Go ahead.
A number of years ago, we had a bill before the legislature that would have required metering of rural wells. It was very contentious, if I remember. Is there anything in this bill or in rule that either prohibits or permits the department to generally require metering of rural wells? In other words, I guess what I'm really interested in, does this, under the enforcement provisions, does this bill open the door for a general requirement under rule that these wells be metered?
Chair Cannon, Representative Thompson, this bill does not raise the issue of metering. It does not modify the authorities with regard to metering at all. As I was speaking earlier, the authorities of the water master, there is the ability there for the water master to require a meter anytime water is used, and so this bill does not modify that authority. There's nothing here that provides for a blanket metering. No modification of the 537-545 in that regard.
One of my concerns about this is that we all seem to agree that 15,000 gallons, nobody really uses that amount. As you lower the amount down to 5,000 or some other number, we're getting closer to what people actually do use. And I think that opens the door for going back to the metering issue, because how do we know if it's 4,900 or 5,000 or 5,200 if we don't measure it, and if we don't measure it in general? I think that would be a hugely contentious issue to build into something here unbeknownst to water users.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this bill does not, it is silent on the issue of any global metering out there. I do recognize that any time that you have a number in there, it becomes a question of whether you are below or above the number. And as I pointed out, where that would come into play is where there's a complaint or the water master observes something that isn't right. There may be a metering issue, but that would be case by case.
Great, thank you. I want to thank the department. You've been really good to put up with this. This was not your bill, I recognize that, and you have engaged in this process really constructively and helpfully. Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Have we done any guesstimations of how much water that this might preserve, even if, as my friend Representative Vance points out, enforcement would be through an eyeball estimate and honor system as distinct from a measure and catch system? Do we have any estimate of how much water we might be able to, that might be preserved by this bill, and any hunches about what we might, what beneficial uses we might be able to put that water towards?
Representative Smith, the we do not have an estimate of how much water this is going to save, because largely we believe this is not going to be affecting the majority of the, you know, most of the users that are out there. There are going to be some circumstances where folks will meet up against that 5,000 gallons a day. Undoubtedly, that will happen in some events. So I guess that is the short of it. The we're talking about exempt uses, and the inherent problem with exempt uses is that there is no department review of these as they go into place, and so we don't have a list of exempt users that are out there and how much water they're using to be able to quantify a savings.
Thanks.
Great, thank you. And I'm going to, Representative Boone, quickly, and we'll,
okay,
we'll move on.
Well, just in listening to all this, I saw the letter, too, from Richard Kosasin, and it just occurs to me that this really affects mostly, because I come from an area where there's probably more than enough water, and people would not even think about usage of water where I come from most of the time. And that's the coast, if anybody needs to know. But it seems like it affects people in the drier parts of the state. And years ago, I went, and it was in Washington State, but same, you know, right in the east side of the state. The people who live in these areas know that they're limited amounts of water, and they're very creative in how they use it, and when they use it, and when they don't use it. And they're kind of like the kings and queens of conservation measures. And it seems to me like that might be a more user-friendly way for the state to incentivize conservation measures. And in the letter, Richard Kosasin recommends, his group recommends, utilizing the Extension Service and OSU Extension Service to help with the education outreach measures, especially for newer members of communities out in the east side, if they don't know how to use the water as efficiently and effectively as possible, and that those kinds of savings might be, without knowing how much people might use. For example, when you garden, you might use a drip system instead of just an open sprinkler or whatever. But I'm just thinking that that might be an easier and a better way for the state to cut down on excessive use, if that's possible. Because it sounds like it's pretty much complaint-driven right now, and nothing happens until somebody complains about their neighbor using too much water, which I would think a neighbor might say, you know, you could say, help us all save some water by doing blah, blah, blah.
Mr. Chair, Representative, every little bit counts, and I think voluntary measures like that would also be a very big help.
Great. Thank you very much. And I'm going to move on now. We have a number of folks signed up to testify, but I'm going to start with and hopefully leave it with the folks who did not testify at our last hearing on this issue. So that means five others. If you did testify at the last time and you are just absolutely determined to be heard again, this is a public hearing. I don't want to shut you off. So send a note up and let me know that you would really like to testify again today. But I'm going to start with the five who I believe we did not hear from back on the 14th. Let's start with Eric Kanzler and Jerry Schmidt. I'm just taking these in the order that they were signed up. So. Eric, why don't you start?
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Eric Kanzler. I'm the Executive Director of Central Oregon Land Watch. I'm here today to express Land Watch's support for the bill and for the effort to limit the amount of water that can be withdrawn from exempt wells for domestic purposes without a permit. Our position on this matter relates strongly to our concerns over the impacts of exempt wells on groundwater resources and spring flows in the Deschutes Basin. Native fish in the Middle Deschutes and tributaries such as the Crooked and the Notorious Rivers, Whiteches Creek, depend on natural spring complexes and the cold, clean water for their habitat and ultimately for their survival. Future growth in the basin in the form of cities, destination resorts, and exempt wells is predicted to use another 100 cubic feet per second of water by the year 2025, and of course more beyond that. This additional use of the region's limited groundwater supply will likely have a fairly profound impact over time on many of the spring complexes and potentially reducing the flow of spring water into the Middle Deschutes by perhaps as much as 25% and increasing the in-stream temperatures perhaps by several degrees Fahrenheit in places. Overall, projected use by exempt wells is expected to get to account for close to 20% of this overall usage. Imposing tighter limits on the use of groundwater for domestic, the use of groundwater for domestic uses by exempt wells is one of the ways in which greater protection for the basin's limited resources can be achieved. We think this is a strong and also a fair step in the right direction, so we support the passage of this bill and would encourage the Oregon legislature to explore additional steps in the future to preserve groundwater resources in the Deschutes Basin and throughout the state. Thanks.
Thanks, Eric. Jake?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Schmidt. I'm here today representing the Oregon Groundwater Association. We kind of wanted to weigh in on this issue a little bit. One of the things that I gave you in the handout was a graph. I'm a visual person and I like visual. I don't do well with numbers as well as graphs. But I wanted to show you the indication of what's happening in the industry. The yellow indications are the actual well reports filed for geotech holes. The middle one is the light blue, which is water wells, and you can see they've gone from around 6,400 in 2005 to around 3,000 in 2009. Drastic decline in the industry itself. The third bar graph is indicating monitoring wells. Those are wells that are drilled just for measuring water levels and that type of thing. I can't give you an indication of what's happening so far in 2010 because it's too early. My preliminary assessment looking at January, it's down 75% over last year. It's a little bit early yet to give that kind of thing because drillers have 30 days to hand in their reports, so there's more reports that could come in.
And Jerry, you've provided a lot of written testimony. I hope that you'll summarize it.
Yeah, I'm not going through all the written testimony.
Yeah,
by anybody.
We still have
you
several more people to hear from in just another 15 minutes on this.
And you guys can read, so I don't need to insult you there. The other portion of the graph, when you look at those, realize those are well reports. Now, in those well reports, those aren't just domestic wells. When I did a graph for 2008 for Marion County, I found out that only 44% of them were domestic wells. The rest of them are alterations, deepenings, and abandonments. So, and then I gave you some information on breakdowns. What I really wanted to talk to you a little bit about is what you, Mr. Chair, came up with about, well, number one, how do we regulate this? How do we come with a volume number? And really, the folks spoke about it here a couple of times, is that really our governing structure here is 537-525, which says we can only use the amount beneficial use without waste. Somehow or another, we need to get that concept right up front so people understand that that's the issue, that you can only use the beneficial amount without waste. Wanted to also just comment briefly that you 280 gallons a day. I did a symposium back in December, sponsored by Oregon State, and I came up with the numbers using what an urban user versus a rural user uses. You can see that's almost identical. At that same conference, Benton County was there. They came up with their numbers with an outside consultant. If you read the excerpts that I gave you, the numbers are the same. They also come up with a figure that we're using as an exempt user, roughly around 2% of the groundwater in Benton County is exempt groundwater uses, and these are actual measurements. So, again, I'm getting back to the thing about if you're trying to establish a limit, a volume number, an actual number, comes to be problematic. As Mr. Kosasan pointed out, there's a lot of other issues in here. Some of my people do water treatment. They have to process a lot of water sometimes in order to get a usable, drinkable amount of water. So whatever that limit is, you have to be careful so that it doesn't exclude people. Finally, I wanted to tell you two things. One, the Umatilla. In that case, they're in a critical groundwater area. They formed a task force. The task force studied exempt users. They actually made the recommendation that, in fact, exempt users are not affecting the area, so they advised their county commission not to regulate domestic users, and that's in an area that's a critical area. So, and finally, I hope maybe one of the other people can speak to you about the constitutional issues that might arise here. There is some constitutional issues. I'm not a lawyer, so maybe as one of the lawyers comes up, they can talk to you about that, or Major 49 issues as well. So thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to take so much time.
No, you did great. Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you.
Any quick questions?
Thank you.
And let's hear next from Dave Honeycutt, Kimberly Priestley, and Roger Beyer. I think I'm right that none of you testified last month.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association and the Oregon Small Woodlands Association, speaking for them also. Both groups are opposed to House Bill 3661 as it is presented today. The issue somewhat is focused this morning on the $5,000 to $15,000 number, and that number, I mean, that's one arbitrary number going to a lower arbitrary number. I have no idea where the 15,000 gallon per day number came from. I don't know of any science that was behind it. I have no idea where the 5,000 gallon number came from. I have not aware of any science behind it. I want to focus my testimony more to subsection 2 of subsection 1 of the bill. My groups of both feel that is probably the most problematic section of this bill, and the fact that the department could require a permit to be drilled before exempt uses, specifically for stock watering. If in need of water for dairy cows, you can't wait 8 months in order to get a permit in order to water your dairy cows. That just doesn't work. Cows need water every day.
I'm sorry, Mr. Beyer, can you repeat that again? Are you suggesting that this bill would affect the ability of a farmer to water their stock?
I am suggesting that if the Groundwater Water Resources Commission declares an area to be limited or critical, and then could then require permit prior to drilling of a new well in those areas, that yes, it could inhibit the watering of stock.
Okay, we'll have to get some follow-up on that from the department. Thanks. Go ahead.
And then the same issue for the people who want to live on their land in the forest. Those people, before they can live on their land in the forest, they need to have a water source. And the most common water source, obviously, is to drill a well, an exempt well. And those people in those potential areas, and I believe this bill would give the Water Resources Department or Commission the ability to create more limited or critical groundwater areas around the state. And I believe that by adding that the commission may adopt rules to implement, administer, and enforce subsection 2 of this section, which is the new section being added, I believe that does point the department and the commission to adopt rules specifically on that issue. So, Mr. Chair, that is the reason that both of these groups that I represent today are opposed to this bill in its current form.
Thank you. Dave?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action. I'm sorry to be late to this party, but we're here also in opposition to House Bill 3661 for two primary reasons. There are approximately 4,000 or so Measure 49 applicants. That was pared down from the original 7,500 Measure 37 claimants. When Measure 49 passed, it gave all those claimants the ability to file a new claim under Measure 49 with some significantly altered rights, essentially the restoration of rights that were taken over the years as we've changed land use regulations and limited what people can do. That 4,000, that list of 4,000 claimants is primarily elderly, and they're almost all from rural areas. This is a Measure 37 and 49, for those of you who haven't tracked that those measures much, is really affects rural areas. It's a rural issue. It always has been, and I suspect it will be going forward. Most of the Measure 49 claims are in Clackamas and Washington County. I would say over half of the total number of claims come from Clackamas and Washington County, and a number of them are alongside the hills in both Clackamas and Washington County. Most of Washington County, the hillsides, and a significant portion of Clackamas County is in groundwater limited areas already. The legislature knew that in 2007 when you passed House Bill 3540, which created Measure 49, and because there were some suggestions that we didn't want too much development going into those groundwater limited or critical areas, the legislature took that into account and limited people's ability in those areas to apply for what's known under Measure 49 as the fast track, Section 6, up to 3 homes. If this bill passes, those Measure 49 claimants who've jumped through the hurdles twice now, once under Measure 37, and then when those were taken away, a second time under Measure 49, could potentially watch as their Measure 49 claims evaporate if we get the Water Resources Department or Commission to indicate that they will have to obtain a permit in order to drill a well pursuant to their Measure 49 claims, which seems ironic since the legislature's already thought of this, already dealt with that, and addressed it directly in Measure 49. Now, not only were they limited to the 3 homes under the language in Measure 49, but now they may have to go in and get a permit, and saying that they're going to get a permit is one thing, but of course, when you go to get a permit, not all of those permits are going to be approved. And so I suspect what you'll see if this bill passes is a whole series of additional Measure 49 claims by those Measure 49 claimants. Measure 49 doesn't just apply retroactively. It also applies prospectively. So if the legislature adopts new regulations that limit or prohibit residential use of real property or farm and forest practices, that will trigger Measure 49 claims. I see this legislation, and maybe not this legislation, but a subsequent act by the Water Resources Commission pursuant to this legislation as triggering Measure 49 claims. Not only is it, but it doesn't just affect the 4,000 Measure 49 claimants, it also affects, as I read the bill, every rural property owner, potentially, at least those with domestic wells. The bill, Section 4 of the bill, I think is meant to limit the scope of the application of the bill by indicating that it applies only to uses of groundwater that are initiated after the effective date of the bill. That's fine. But if someone's well dries up, if someone's domestic well gets contaminated, those people then would be required to go in and drill a new well. If they go in and drill a new well, they're essentially, as I read Section 4, initiating a use. At that point, would they have to go in and get a water resources permit? I live in a rural area. I have a domestic well. If my well dries up, I can't wait 8 months to go in and get a permit while I try and get a permit that may or may not be granted in order to start using to drill a new well so that I can have water for domestic purposes at my house. And I don't think my neighbors can wait that long either. So the way that this bill is drafted, I think, will trigger Measure 49 claims every time the Water Resources Department or the commissioner, whoever it is, goes out and imposes permitting requirements on domestic wells by the claims by the current residents of that particular area, that or at least those that are on domestic wells. So I think you've got a fiscal issue here. I would certainly recommend that this go at least be reviewed by legislative fiscal to see what the fiscal is, and I would suspect that should Water Resources Department rule make and declare an area as a and limit domestic wells in that area, that you will see a whole slew of Measure 49 lawsuits. If it happens in my area, I'll file one myself.
Thank you, Mr. Honeycutt. Kimberly.
For the record, my name is Kimberly Parisi. I'm here representing Water Watch of Oregon. Chair Cannon, members of the committee, I've passed out written testimony, so I won't, in the interest of time, I won't go through all those points. But I just wanted to, I did want to lend our support to this bill. We see this as a modest advancement in the statutes that govern exempt, the drilling of exempt wells in this state. I did want to say that from our perspective, this bill, what it does is it gives the Water Resources Department just more tools. It's not, we do not believe this is that prescriptive of a bill. Water Watch was part of a committee that was convened, I think many of the people in this room were on that committee, to study or to, you know, to analyze the exempt wells, the exempt well laws. Water Watch, I think as many of you know, has long pushed for the permitting of exempt wells. We got a lot of pushback on that, saying that really the department can sort of deal with the issues of exempt wells through their management of these things. And so from our perspective, these are modest advancements which simply give them the tool to regulate or require permitting if problems arise. And if anyone has any questions on the specifics of our written comments, I would be happy.
Thank you. And I'm sure that members will be disappointed to hear that we're going to move on to another issue. We've discussed this a few times in committee. Perhaps this will be the last, but I'll get a sense of where committee members are at on this bill before making any decisions about how to proceed. Thank you for coming to testify today. Hope I didn't exclude anybody who had hoped to. I should note that Mr. Kosasin signed up in support of the bill, but I think that was a mistake. I think that he's not in support, if I read his memo correctly. I know that he's been in touch with members individually, and Sean Jillians and Peggy Lynch also were signed up, and they can be in touch individually as well. So, with that, I'm going to close a public hearing on House Bill 3661 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3613. You'll notice that we have a limited amount of time, just 25 minutes to deal with this. We have a number of folks signed up to testify, so I'm going to ask you to keep it brief, and I'll be setting time limits for each panel, and we'll try to move very quickly through most, if not all, of the people on this list. Let's start with Terry Thompson, Gus Gates, and Liz Hamilton. And Commissioner Thompson, really appreciate you being back here again today in your advocacy on this bill. We did hear from you last month, and glad to see you back in the Capitol again.
Thank you. My name is Terry Thompson. I represent Lincoln County. I'm the commissioner there. I'll make this very brief and let the other gentlemen who haven't already testified in front of the committee, and if you have questions, I'm here because I think this is an important bill to Lincoln County. The state of Oregon has a policy of renewable resources being more important than non-renewable resources. And in Lincoln County, our strongest industries come from the ocean. One of them is tourism and just people that like to be there with the ocean. And the most important industry is fishing. So we already had a ban on oil wells. All this does is extend the ban, and it's a challenge because the fishing industry, which needs ground to participate in it, is very important to our local economy. It produces about $100 million a year into Lincoln County. So quite simply, this extends what's already there. We think it's a good bill for our area of the coast, and would appreciate you supporting it.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner.
Chair Cannon, members of the House Committee of Environment and Water, for the record, my name is Gus Gates, Oregon Policy Coordinator for the Surfrider Foundation and a lifelong coastal resident from the community of Florence. On behalf of our over 600 Surfrider Foundation members in Oregon, recreational ocean users, beachgoers, and aquatic enthusiasts, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to provide comments in support of House Bill 3613. The Surfrider Foundation is very supportive of legislation to create a permanent moratorium on offshore oil and gas leasing and drilling within Oregon's territorial sea. Oregon's Pacific Ocean, waves, and beaches are vital recreational, economic, and ecological treasures that will be polluted by any offshore oil and gas drilling. Just as Commissioner Thompson mentioned before me, Oregon has a proud history of keeping offshore oil and gas drilling out of our Oregon Ocean Stewardship Area. Our territorial sea plan was the first of its kind to be developed in the nation. The main focus of the plan, as well as statewide planning goal 19, was to give priority to the protection and conservation of renewable marine resources, as well as the encouragement of beneficial uses of ocean resources such as navigation, food production, recreation, aesthetic enjoyment, and uses of the seafloor, provided that such activities do not adversely affect the resources to be protected. With this in mind, it only makes common sense to create a permanent moratorium on offshore oil and gas leasing, or else we threaten the very foundation and original intent of Goal 19 and the Territorial Sea Plan. Some have said that offshore oil drilling only poses a threat to the environment in the event of a spill. In fact, offshore oil drilling poses a significant threat to marine environments in many ways, including the introduction of drilling fluid additives into the environment, which can harm or kill fish and other marine life. Drilling muds routinely discharge toxic metals such as lead, mercury, and cadmium. Produced water contains dangerous levels of radioactive materials and carcinogens such as benzene, toluene, and arsenic. If Oregon were to open its waters to offshore oil and gas drilling, serious impacts to ecosystem health would occur, as well as subsequent impacts to Oregon's economy and coastal communities. As recreational ocean users, we are very concerned about the potential threat of offshore oil and gas drilling in Oregon. We feel that efforts in Oregon should be focused on a comprehensive and sustainable energy plan that includes energy conservation as a top priority. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gates. Go ahead.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Liz Hamilton. I have the good fortune of serving as the Executive Director for the Northwest Sport Fishing Industry Association. We represent over 300 businesses in the Northwest, where sport fishing generates over $3 billion in economic benefits, in addition to the cultural and environmental benefits that sport fishing bring to our coastline. Our businesses depend on an open, healthy, and unencumbered ocean environment. And as such, we have deep concerns about opening the Oregon coastline to offshore drilling. It would compromise vital habitat, fish species, and some of the most important crab grounds really in the world. So we support House Bill 3613. We think these protections made sense the first time the ban was passed, and they still make sense today. You know, as a business organization, we are sensitive to other industries and economic development, but this is something that we just don't think pencils out for Oregon. We don't think the benefits outweigh the risks that this introduced to our coastline and to the natural resources that many, many industries depend upon. So I'm going to be brief. I've already turned in written testimony. I just want to thank you for the opportunity to give testimony today.
Really appreciate you being here, Ms. Hamilton.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions or comments?
Thanks.
Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you.
Sorry,
Mr. Chair. I'm looking at line 10. In the event the governor determines that an oil embargo substantially affects the supply of oil to the United States as an exception to Section 1, which prohibits the leases. Why, and I'm not sure whether this is a question for the panel or somebody else, but why would we have an exception that allows the governor to make this finding and therefore allow for leases?
You want me to go ahead even though...
you want to take a stab at it?
In case of a national emergency, I mean, you've got to have a priority for certain types of fuel. And if you would have no other supply, then we'd probably have to go to it. But it would be a national emergency before a governor, I'm sure, would want that to happen on this coast. And it gives you a possibility of a way. And you know, as a fisherman, I can't catch fish if I don't have fuel in the tank. And that's the same way I look at the country. I mean, you've got to have it. So it gives you the method to allow you to harvest it if it's absolutely necessary.
Thank you.
And do we know whether there are standards that the governor would use in determining whether an oil embargo substantially affects the supply of oil in the United States?
I'm not aware of any.
I haven't heard of any.
Might be a question. If it's answerable, it might be by some of the agency folks who are going to...
Just a quick comment, yeah. Then. It occurs to me this is a big loophole in this bill. And if we really ran into that kind of a problem, I suspect a special session might be a more appropriate way of managing it rather than leaving it to the governor. But because, after all, oil and gas exploration is not a quick solution to an oil embargo problem anyway.
Yeah, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Smith.
Representative Barr makes an interesting point that hadn't occurred to me, a good one, but mine is different. We might also consider very briefly, when we go forward to analyzing use of our coasts, also impacts something like this would have on real estate values and tourism values. Small point, but as we get, and I know there's ideological rifts. We just came out of a tricky ballot initiative, etc. But I think there's a couple other economic interests we should be considering as we do coastal planning.
Could I respond to that?
Yeah.
I also think the other thing that you don't see is the agricultural values. I mentioned before that the state of Oregon is considered around the world to be one of the cleanest environments. And in certain places in the world, our food is sought because of that reputation. When you put oil well drilling off your coast, it would have some impacts on our impression by other people, whether it's factual or not, that our food might be in some way tainted. Right now, we really have an unusual place in the world because we are seen as one of the cleanest places for food production.
Thank you, Commissioner. Thanks to all three of you for being here, making the trip from the coast. We have a few agency folks. Let's get Mr. Doherty. Why don't you step up next? Look forward to hearing from you. And then on deck, we'll have Steve Purchase, Vicki McConnell, and Bob Bailey. So we might get close to getting through.
Good morning, Mr.
Good morning.
Chair, members of the committee. Brian Doherty here testifying in on behalf of the Western States Petroleum Association in opposition to this bill. And I'll tell you why. I want to talk a little bit about energy security and national energy strategy, safety, and diversification. And what I first want to say is that there has been exploration in the 60s. There has been no proven commercial quantities of oil or natural gas off the Oregon coast. There has been no intentions for my companies of going into this. But I think we ought to talk about something to do with looking at U.S. energy resources. And I think there's another way to do this besides an outright ban. The U.S. currently imports almost two-thirds of its oil from foreign countries, many of which are politically unstable and others which are outright hostile to U.S. interests. We have to look at the energy resources in terms of potential future development. President Obama, in his recent State of the Union address, stated that he called for opening new areas for offshore oil and gas development as part of a comprehensive national energy strategy. Again, we don't have an intention to do now, but we don't know what comes up in the future. Concerns about safety of the offshore oil and gas can be discussed. One of them is the record of production in California, the only West Coast, the only place offshore oil and gas production is currently occurring in the West Coast. For the past 40 years, since 1970, they have produced over 1 billion barrels of oil off the Santa Barbara coast, and with only 850 barrels that have been spilled in 40 years. My math tells me that's less than 1/100 of 1%. I also would suggest that the values, the land values off Santa Barbara have not been seriously affected if you've ever tried to buy property in Santa Barbara County. The U.S. energy security has to be improved by utilizing all of our resources efficiently. That includes natural resources, renewable energy, all sorts of technologies that are coming in on board. And I think those are all important, including being able to use our best resources that we have here. I think you will find that we've had a prior legislature issue a moratorium, and I want to be clear, there's a difference between a ban and a moratorium. In 1989, when this was first introduced, it was a moratorium. It went for 5 years. I think it was not renewed. Nothing has happened. It got renewed again in 2007. And I think a moratorium is a better means of going, whether it's for 4 years. I think they've been 4 or 5 year moratoriums that have been on. It has not been a ban to date that's been on this, which I consider to be a permanent ban.
Just to clarify, the distinction in your mind being that a moratorium would have a end date.
So yes.
It would be this bill with a sunset on it.
Yes.
Thanks.
In order to do something like expiration, I agree completely with Representative Barnhart. I would think the time between applying for permits for exploration production and actually having an ongoing platform is probably in the neighborhood of 10 years. So you're not talking about something that is going to be reacting quickly. You have ample time for people to discuss the benefits or the detriments to such an action off the Oregon coast. I'd also like to say that the track record of bans, legislative bans, or legislative mandates to predict the future has not been good, and I would give an example of your 2007 mandate for ethanol that was here to reduce the carbon content of our fuels, and we found now from the California Air Resources Board that Midwest corn-based ethanol has now got a higher carbon footprint than California gasoline. So I would suggest we take a look at this. There is not some imminent threat here of platforms going off the Oregon coast, but I do think we should look at this in terms of a national energy strategy and energy security and not be permanently banning things at this time. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Derby. The agency representatives, Mr. Pruchis, Mr. Bailey, Ms. O'Connell. Go ahead. So we'll have, if we can keep this panel to about 5 minutes, then I think we'll get within spitting distance of finishing on time.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Steve, and members of the committee, I'm Steve Purchase, Assistant Director for the Department of State Lands. I will make my comments very brief. I'm here today to support House Bill 3613 on prohibiting oil and gas exploration and development within the territorial sea. The department agrees that the risk is too great to the environment and our recreational commercial fisheries on the coast, despite possible gains that may accrue to the Common School Fund. For this reason, the department concurs with legislative findings in ORS 196-410, and we are certainly going to support the bill. In closing, the department supports the bill, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you. Ms. McConnell.
Thank you, Chair Cannon and members of the committee. My name is Vicki McConnell, and I'm the state geologist and the director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. I'm here because there's actually a clause in here for the agency, and I just wanted to make sure that first to thank Representative Cannon and his work on this bill, that you have thought about whether there would be some interest for science if we needed any type of research or scientific research, that clause is in there, and to assure you that we do not at this time have any offshore oil rig ready to go out there and do any kind of drilling.
No.
So we understand the policy, and we support the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Committee members, nice to be in front of you again. For all the reasons we've discussed at previous work sessions, the Department of Land Conservation, for the record, Bob Bailey, Coastal Program Division Manager at Department of Land Conservation Development. For all the reasons we've discussed before, the department does support this bill. We believe it makes a demonstration of the state's commitment towards renewable resources, and both energy resources, food resources, the aesthetic resources of our coastal ocean, and gives the the state ample reason to go forward down a path that looks at renewable energy sources rather than the non-renewable. So we do support the bill, and thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Yeah, Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed, Mr. Purchase, that you indicate that the department continues the moratorium as opposed to the ban. Is that by design that you use the word moratorium?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Betts, no, I believe that was an error. I support the bill.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Finally, we will hear from Brock Howell, Ivan Molesky, and Tom Wolf. Welcome, Brock.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Cannon, members of the committee. My name is Brock Howell. I am the State Policy Advocate for Environment Oregon. We have more than 30,000 members statewide. We work to protect clean air, clean water, and open space. And I'm here in support of this bill, and I want to highlight three reasons for why we do. Number one is it's going to make sure that we protect our coastal jobs and businesses, as been highlighted. We had a report that came out in November or end of October that showed that our coastal economy represents about $1.2 billion, and that's just from tourism and fishing. And so it's definitely a vital interest to be able to protect that. We also believe that we need to shift more of our clean energy policy or our energy policy on the coast towards clean energy like ocean power and less for offshore drilling. And so this is an important element to make sure that happens. And finally, that there's a very high risk of toxic pollutants and oil spills occurring if we do allow offshore drilling. And obviously that would harm fish and our health. I would like to make a couple of other points outside of the written testimony I've provided. With regard to the value of real estate, obviously that is tied into the coastal economy, and it exceeds the value of the $1.2 billion figure that I've presented. I have seen estimates for the value of our coast that exceed $2 billion, and I assume that they may incorporate some of those values. In terms of agriculture, Commissioner Thompson made an excellent point as far as the agriculture industry and how it's viewed as clean. I'd like to point out if we had toxic pollution coming from oil drilling rigs, that would likely contaminate fish, and it would not only be a perception but a reality that our fish that we sold may have toxins in them, and that is a good reason to be able to protect our fishing industry from that occurring. There is very little oil, which has been mentioned. This would not be able to solve an energy crisis, which is one of the reasons I'm not concerned about the provision of having the governor remove the temporary moratorium for a temporary amount of time in a time of national crisis. I don't see that happening. And finally, there is very little possibility of us having a higher carbon footprint, as is the case with our ethanol mandate, because this is a ban on offshore oil drilling, and I can't imagine there being an unintended consequence of being a higher footprint at all. So with that, we fully support this as a long-term, as matching our state policy to the long-term vision of our coast. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Cool. Chair Cannon, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the executive director and state council chair of here in Oregon of Trout Unlimited, a group, the largest cold water conservation group in the United States with 2,700 members here in Oregon and 150,000 nationwide. One of the things that is truly least understood in the history of salmon and in their life cycles is the ocean effect on them. One of the things we do understand, though, is that the ocean is cyclical in the benefits, that there's about a 30-year ups and downs on nutrients within the ocean. And right now we are in the midst of a period when there's high nutrients, and therefore we're looking at large returns of different species of salmon coming back to Oregon. We are looking at huge numbers of coastal coho. We are looking at large numbers of spring chinook. Sea run cutthroat numbers are up quite a bit, and this is due to the nutrients, and also due to the hard work that many watershed councils have done across the state. But one of the things we need to worry about is what effect will we have in the ocean, and if you allow offshore drilling, not only with spills, but with the chemicals used in that process, you could have major impacts on these returns of salmon that could benefit coastal communities with recreational fishing, with charters, with people coming into the coastal communities to fish for these fish. As a kid who grew up in the city of Seaside and also in Astoria, I'm very concerned about our coastal communities because they suffer. I mean, my father lives in Manzanita, was a past member of their city council there, and I worry about that area. So we need to, as I worry about fish and I worry about the return of the salmon and the responsibility I have as a conservationist to ensuring the return, I also worry about our coastal communities and the fact that offshore oil wells could bring great devastation to the economy down there in the coast. So I urge that you support this bill. It's a good bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Tom.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, for the record, Ivan Molesky, I'm the Conservation Program Coordinator for the Oregon Chapter of the Sierra Club. On behalf of our approximately 20,000 members, we urge you to support this bill, House Bill 3613. You've heard a lot of great testimony today on why we should extend the moratorium on offshore oil drilling and exploration. I think everyone in Oregon agrees that our coasts are just a world-class, wonderful place, and all these reasons we've heard are valuable reasons for extending the moratorium. Briefly, I wanted to speak to why we should make this ban permanent. And I think that long-term, the burden of proof going forward has to be on why we would need to lift the prohibition and under the need to drill. And not on, the burden of proof should not be on why we should, basically providing a temporary extension every 3 to 5 years, which is the pattern that we've been in. So long-term going forward, I think the legislature, the governor could obviously revisit this question in the future if there's a true need, and so that should be the burden of proof. If there's really a true need, we can revisit this question, and we shouldn't have to be trying to extend this every couple of years. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks all three of you for being so efficient. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brock, just for, and you've got somebody to corroborate this in the back of the room, that the coastal economy is worth much more than $1.3 billion.
I'm sure it is, and indeed, I think the intrinsic value of the coast exceeds that by far. So
we produce quite a bit more just in some of former Representative Thompson's sector. But thanks for pointing it out.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much, everyone who came and testified on the bill today. We will revisit this issue likely on Thursday.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barnhart.
I note from the comments that were made by the opponent to the measure that the issue that I raised about the governor's position really doesn't amount to anything because of the huge lead time for any oil and well exploration. So while I consider it a little bit surplus, I certainly don't object to the bill containing it since it effectively is a nullity anyway.
Great.
That's a usual excuse.
With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3613. Thank you, members, for staying until 11, and we will adjourn the House Environment and Water Committee till Thursday morning.